This time of year, your home can become a destination for some unwelcome visitors. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day, and ISU Extension entomologist Donald Lewis will be here to talk about the creepy crawlies who are applying for roommate status. Donald and Richard Giron from Iowa State University Extension will also answer your questions about your yard or garden. And this is the final day of our very short fall membership drive. Now is the time for you to invest in your public radio station. Think for just a few minutes about how much you depend on Iowa Public Radio for news you can trust and great conversation and the opportunity to be a part of those conversations. And remember that we can't do what we do here without you. Call 800-897-9204 or give online at iowapublicradio.org. Thank you.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton says the administration wants to give Pakistan $2 billion in military assistance over several years. NPR's Michelle Kellerman reports the money would be used to bolster Pakistan's fight against militants along the border with Afghanistan, an effort that has been criticized by the White House in recent weeks.
Obama administration officials have been holding several days of high-level talks with their Pakistani counterparts on everything from energy security to counterterrorism. The U.S. wants to see Pakistan do more to fight militants in border areas near Afghanistan. The aid would be spread out over 5 years and, if approved by Congress, would be in addition to an existing five-year, $7.5 billion non-military aid package. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, the State Department.
An apparent outbreak of cholera has killed at least 138 people in Haiti and sickened more than 1,000 others. Relief groups are rushing to get medicine to the area. David Darg with the group Operation Blessing says hospitals in that region are overwhelmed.
They've been having to recuperate following the earthquake just a few months back, and they were just absolutely inundated with patients today, so facing very difficult scenes.
Haitian health officials are concerned the disease could spread to sprawling tent camps that are housing hundreds of thousands of people displaced by last winter's earthquake. The Pentagon's policy barring gays from serving openly in the military is back on again while a federal appeals court considers the issue. But NPR's Rachel Martin reports a new order from Defense Secretary Robert Gates could effectively freeze discharges of openly gay service members.
Gates issued a new directive that the decision to discharge someone under Don't Ask, Don't Tell has to be made by one of the four service chiefs, the Pentagon's general counsel, and the personnel chief, Clifford Stanley. Stanley sent out a separate memo saying the Department of Defense is still urging service members not to, quote, alter their personal behavior during this legally uncertain time. Rachel Martin, NPR News, Washington.
Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner and his counterparts from the other G20 leading economies are meeting in South Korea today. The BBC's John Sudworth says they're trying to agree on a common approach to problems in the currency markets.
Officially, the G20 finance ministers are discussing issues like banking regulation and reform of the IMF. But of course, exchange rate policy, in particular Washington's accusation that Beijing is manipulating its currency to benefit its exporters, is the issue of the day, so it's likely to loom large in the discussions. Agreement seems unlikely, though. From China's perspective, the real problem is the loose monetary policy in the West that's pushing large flows of foreign investment towards Asia, leaving governments little choice but to intervene in the money markets.
The BBC's John Sudworth. On Wall Street, stock prices are mixed. The Dow is down 10 points. The Nasdaq is up 12. This is NPR News.
It's 10:04. I'm Dennis Reese, Iowa Public Radio News headlines. A survey of rural bankers in Iowa and nine other Midwest and Plains states indicates growing optimism about the regional economy, despite mixed financial signals. The Economic Confidence Index from Creighton University has increased in the current Rural Main Street Economic Report. The Iowa Board of Regents wants to know how universities in other states are dealing with budget cuts. The board will spend time next week studying how other schools have dealt with reduced funding without resorting to tuition hikes. Allergy sufferers in Iowa may have to suffer a little longer this year because of warmer-than-usual weather. Experts say a good rain could help, but longer-term relief may not happen until Iowa has a hard freeze to kill mold. Authorities say a police officer pulled a man out of his car moments before it was hit by a Union Pacific freight train in Nevada. The Iowa State Patrol says the driver drove into a railroad intersection about 8 p.m. last night and got stuck on the tracks. A police officer helped the driver get out of the car. Moments later, the car was hit by the train. The patrol says an investigation is underway and charges are pending. Authorities say an autopsy is pending on a body found in a tent near Underwood in western Iowa. The Pottawatomie County Sheriff's Office says that a farmer found the body in the tent in a field yesterday afternoon. Sergeant Dwayne Ritchie says the body was badly decomposed, making initial attempts at identification impossible. Partly to mostly sunny in Iowa today, warm, highs in the upper 60s north to the 70s in the south. It's 10:06.
Support for NPR comes from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age.
Hi, I'm Ben Kiefer from Iowa Public Radio, asking you to make that pledge of support right now. Go to iowapublicradio.org, or if you'd rather, dial our toll-free number, 800-897-9204. We all know how hectic mornings can be, with those mouths to feed, getting the backpacks ready, kids off to school, getting the pets in and out. We all have our routines to help us get through the day, and we know Iowa Public Radio is a big part of that routine that makes the day better. We're here every morning with news from far and wide, and close to home, too. So won't you take a moment to consider the value this public radio service provides to you and support the station that is here for you every morning? Every day, make your contribution at iowapublicradio.org. That's iowapublicradio.org. And thanks.
This is Renee Montaigne, and you probably know what we're about to ask you. We ask it every year around this time. There's nothing subliminal when it comes to public radio fundraising. But there's one more thing we want to ask, and that is, how do you see the world? Do you look at things in black and white? Red state, blue state, one side of the aisle, or the other? Or maybe you find there are lots of complicated issues with lots of shades of gray and not much time in the day to understand it all. There are not many news networks that take the time to give us a full picture of the world's issues. NPR does, day in, day out. And so by the time you pull into your driveway, you've been fully briefed on things that mattered, like healthcare and Haiti and the economy. So think of fundraising time as a chance to reflect on how NPR is always there for you, giving you the clearest picture possible of a very complicated world. But there is something that is very simple, and that is you can fill out a check or go online, and that'll let you feel good about doing your part to help make public radio happen. And thank you.
Here's how you can make that pledge of support. Call us now at 800-897.
This is Renee Montaigne.
9204, or go to iowapublicradio.org. It's easy to make a pledge. It's important that you make a pledge, and it makes a big difference in what we do here in public radio. 800-897-9204.
This is Ira Glass of PRI's This American Life. And over the last decade in this country, we've seen a real divide between what goes on at regular radio stations and here on public radio. Regular radio gets more homogenized every year. The same few formats everywhere, not a lot of personality. There are a couple good shows here and there, but by and large, it's pretty repetitive. Meanwhile, public radio just gets bigger and bigger. It's sort of corny, but I think that that's because what happens here every day, among other things, just has more heart. Even on our worst day, on our worst show, you can tell that we are here for idealistic reasons. We want news that's more in-depth. We want real analysis of what's going on around us. We want to know about new music that's not being played elsewhere, new writers we might like. And there's still the idea here every day that part of our job is to invent something new right here on the radio. It's a public space, a public square. And it's funded by public support. That's people like you and me who believe in this kind of thing. We pitch in together. We hope you can help out.
Here's that number. It's 800-897-9204. Make that pledge of support or go to iowapublicradio.org. This is how everything comes to you all throughout the years. It's a really basic message about public radio. There's not really too many ways to sell it other than you fund it, period. Make that pledge of support. It does make something wonderful happen at iowapublicradio.org. Thanks.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. It is Horticulture Day, and this time of year, it's not uncommon to find yourself sharing your bedroom, your bathroom, maybe your kitchen cupboards with some unwelcome visitors. Richard Giron will join us in just a few minutes. But right now, Iowa State University Extension entomologist Donald Lewis is here to talk about our insect friends. Hi, Donald.
Hello, Charity. How are you doing?
I'm very good. How are you?
Doing great. Loving the weather.
Yeah, it has been fantastic. But it is time when we do start to see these bugs make their way into our homes. Why do we start to see this in the fall?
Well, this is the annual migration, you could say, of several very common insects. Just to set the stage, we are talking about the perennial favorite for over a century, and that is the box elder bug. For the last decade to decade and a half, that invader has been joined by a relatively new species called the multicolored Asian lady beetle. So lady beetle or lady bug is well known for this invasion in the fall of the year. And then, of course, this is the time of the year we may see some spiders, we may see some elm leaf beetles. There's a few other incidentals that join this list. But it starts with box elder bug and multicolored Asian lady beetle, who are just following their evolutionary blueprint that existed long before there were houses. And what happens with these insects is that when the days grow short, when the sun comes up late and goes down early, and when we've had some cold temperatures, and then when it's 70 or 60 or 70 degrees in the middle of the day, they begin to move and try to secret themselves into protected locations where they will have a better chance of surviving the winter. Unfortunately, some of those protected locations become our houses when they get on the other side of the siding. But this is the natural evolutionary adaptation of these insects to get into protected locations to make it for through the winter.
And you mentioned box elder bugs, the Asian ladybug, millipedes. There are some spiders that make your way into the home. Is there anything that's dangerous, anything we need to worry about?
None of these are harmful to our health or our property. Millipedes are year-round, not just a fall invader, and people know that one because of the wet summer we've had, and they are still migrating on nights that are warm enough. Not last night when it got down into the 30s, but on warm nights they will continue to migrate. And none of these bite or sting. None of them can carry diseases. None of them feed on the house, its structure, its contents, its occupants. None of these are going to eat small children or large pets. So as far as being a serious problem, they are not dangerous in the normal sense of the word. But yes, they are annoying. They are disturbing. They interfere with emotional health and well-being. So they are a pest, but it's not a dangerous kind of pest like we think of some other things like wasps and bees and mosquitoes.
Right. Well, my three-year-old son would beg to differ. He's been delighted with all the ladybugs coming into our house.
Oh, and people's cats will love crickets. Right. We can add crickets to this list of accidental invaders, though we haven't seen many crickets for the last couple of years. So that one is lower on people's lists. And of course, as soon as I say that, someone will correct me by saying, no, we've got more crickets this year than ever. But people know that kind of invasion as well. And yeah, there is some benefit. Your cats may play with them. Your children may play with them. But beyond that, there's not a lot that we can do with these that's going to be of any benefit to us.
Is there any way to prevent them from coming into your house?
Well, we can certainly talk about the tried and true techniques. And my predecessors in Extension 50 years ago were telling people to seal up cracks and gaps where box elder bugs and spiders and others crawl in. And we continue to say that is our first line of defense, is to try to make your house as insect-proof as possible, fully recognizing that that is easier said than done. People put on new siding, they buy new windows, they make their house as weathertight as possible, and insects that have nowhere to go and all day to get there will still find their way through cracks and gaps and appear on the inside of the house. They have to have crawled through a crack or a gap. There's no miracle teleporting or anything like that going on. They had to have crawled in through a crack and a gap, and that would be our first line of defense. Some people, some places, some corporations, some businesses like hospitals and food plants will spray the outside of the building. They will spray the property, the ground around the building, and that insecticide barrier gives you a little more defense, but it's not foolproof. So the prevention still is what it's been in the past. Seal up cracks and gaps and other openings. Spray if you think it's warranted and beneficial. Spray outside as a prevention. We don't recommend spraying inside as a cure.
And when they do get in the house, where for people who feel uncomfortable about that, what do you recommend?
Keep the shop vac, the dust buster, the vacuum cleaner, keep it at hand and suck them up. And I know I've heard back from people who say they could do it five times a day and they would still have more than they want. But physically eliminating them by picking them up, sweeping them up, vacuuming them up, and discarding them is the practical control on the inside. Most of these will die eventually from crawling around in the dry environment of the house. They will die eventually. So using an insecticide inside the house doesn't really help you very much, because all you do is maybe kill them an hour or two earlier than they were going to die anyway. But there are inside insecticides that you can use to spray on the insects to help you with this cleanup process. But spraying the inside of the house is frequently too little, too late. They are already in. The damage is already done. The annoyance is already present. What you're trying to do is just clean them up. And you might as well do that without insecticides instead of adding insecticides to your environment.
All right. And I made a mistake when we were talking about the show beforehand that I think a lot of people make, and you've corrected, I'm sure, many times on the air. But I referred to the Asian ladybug as the Japanese beetle, but these are completely different bugs.
Completely different. And it's interesting that we have two insects that are both fairly new to Iowa. The Japanese beetle is only found in 47 counties in the state of Iowa. Back in July and August, they were the brightly colored beetles that were eating your roses, your grape foliage, the linden leaves, and a few other plants like raspberries. They are a member of the June bug group. They are very large. They are plant eaters. The multicolored Asian lady beetle, which has a similar sounding name, Japanese, Asian, I guess that sounds alike. The multicolored Asian lady beetle is a ladybug, definitely a beneficial insect in the summer in the trees and in the fields and gardens where they eat aphids and other small insects. Only in the fall of the year does that ladybug become an annoyance and a nuisance by this entering the houses.
All right. And you did mention, though, that there is another bug that could be coming our way that could become a real nuisance.
Oh, if you're following the East Coast news outlets, you have heard this unlikely name, brown marmorated stink bug. Marmorated is the funniest name I've seen for an insect in a long time. It's not marmalated, like people tend to hear. It's marmorated, which is a fancy 25-cent word for marbled. It has a brown and white speckled appearance on its back, and it feeds on all crops, all trees, all shrubs, all flowers. It's going to be a terrible nuisance to vegetable growers, fruit growers, corn and soybean growers. So far, it has only been found in the eastern United States, beginning in the last few years in Pennsylvania, but is now found in 22 states and is as close to us as Ohio and Kentucky. So, and in the fall, this stink bug moves into the house, and it's aptly named It Stinks. So in addition to just having thousands of them on the side of your house, those that do crawl in through cracks and crevices make an unpleasant smell in your house.
Now, of course, we've talked about the emerald ash borer, and one of the ways that people have tried to control the spread of the emerald ash borer, although it hasn't really worked, is to keep people from moving firewood from place to place. With something that feeds on produce, is that something that could be moved around as produce is sent all over the country?
Less likely that we will pack up brown marmorated stink bugs in boxes of lettuce or green peppers or sweet corn in one state and move it to another. The insects are in the fields, primarily in the first part of the summer, and as things ripen and are moved out of the, it's less likely that they would be with the produce. It's possible, but this is an insect that has hit the ground running, as we say, since its accidental introduction into Pennsylvania. It has pretty much flown, crawled, or walked on its own to these other areas, and it does that very well. It's a good flyer. It's a strong flyer, and they disperse very well. The emerald ash borer, we're fortunate, is they're lazy flyers, and the female beetle will only fly as far as she has to find an ash tree, and then she stops. This new insect, the brown marmorated stink bug, is a good flyer and has dispersed very well in a very short period of time.
So we will probably see them before too long.
We hope not, but we've hoped that with every other invasive species since the European corn borer, the starling, the house sparrow, crabgrass, on and on. There's this list of things that didn't used to be here that arrived, and once they get here, they pretty much spread wherever they want to go.
It's Horticulture Day on Talk of Iowa. I'm talking with Iowa State University Extension entomologist Donald Lewis and Iowa State University Extension horticulturist Richard Geron is here as well. They are here to answer your questions about your yard, your garden, or any insect friends maybe you have encountered. The number to call is 866-780-9100. You can also tweet us at IPR Talk. You can send us email at talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Richard, I want to start with a question that I know you've been asked before, particularly in Ames and in Iowa City. Ginkgo trees have recently dropped their fruit, and mm-hmm. ginkgo fruit has a remarkable odor that smells a lot like vomit. And many people wonder where this comes from and why we have them in so many of our towns.
Well, the ginkgo tree is native to China. It's a very ancient tree. It has very few insect or disease pests. And so it's a nice tree in that regard. But it has male and female trees. And the female trees produce these fruit that when they fall on the ground in the fall, they do have a very disagreeable odor. Kind of smells like rancid butter or something of like that nature. But it's only the females. But when they plant trees, oftentimes in the past, they didn't know what they were. They didn't know if they were male or female. And it so happens that many of them were female and they're producing these fruit.
So it's just pure luck.
Well, nowadays, when you go to the garden center, they typically sell male cultivars only, trees that do not produce the fruit. So hopefully nowadays, if you want a ginkgo, you go to the garden center and you buy a male cultivar.
I've been surprised that these ginkgos have stuck around for so long. Have you seen places remove them because of the smell?
Well, they actually have removed them in the city of Ames. Okay. There were some downtown, and
I remember that well from when I lived there.
That was also part of the bird control process.
Right. It was a kind of a dual thing where you had the fruit and also you had the birds roosting in the tree. So you had both, and they became very, very, very much of a nuisance. And so they removed some of the trees.
All right. Well, if you'd like to join our conversation, give us a call at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Ralph from PowerChic has a question, but Ralph, I'm not sure we can answer this question. You're concerned about mice.
First thing is I heard that the hedge balls, supposedly if you put them on like a tin plate or something, it's supposed to keep the spiders out. And I've been having trouble with deer mice sneaking in the house. And, of course, they get in the kitchen cupboard and do their job in the silverware drawer. And I've stuffed steel wool and all kinds of stuff and foam in holes. But they're just sneakier than all get out.
Yes, and they're motivated. It's another example of where they've got nowhere to go and all day to get there, and they find those small cracks and gaps. Richard and I were talking before the show started that both of us have already experienced fall invasion of mostly the white-footed mouse. They move into they crawl into our houses at this time of the year. And the animal ecologists continue to tell us, seal up cracks and gaps. And I keep crawling under my deck looking for openings, and sure enough, I find another one, and I put some steel wool and some caulking in that one. but you just have to be as persistent as the mice are. The hedge balls, that's a great myth that we can't find any validity to. There are repellent chemicals in the rind of hedge apples. Those have been found and documented. But you have to use steam distillation to get the essential oils out of the hedge ball and then put it directly in the path of the insect to stop them or to repel them. So just because it's ugly and smells bad to us doesn't mean it's going to repel mice and spiders and crickets and other insects. Hedge balls work for insect control only if you have the aim and throwing control of a Sandy Koufax and you can hit them directly when you throw it and it hits them square on the top of the head.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. We'll talk more in a moment. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe, and it is Horticulture Day on Talk of Iowa. With me today are Iowa State University Extension horticulturist Richard Duran and ISU Extension entomologist Donald Lewis. We've been talking about bugs, but you can call us with questions about bugs and questions about your yard or your garden. The number to call, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Barbara's on the line from Roland. Hello, Barbara.
Hi. I have rust in my patches of rust in my lawn, and I want to know what I can do about it.
Well, you really don't have to do much of anything. Rust is a fungal disease. We typically see it more so in late summer, early fall. It typically occurs when the grass is no longer growing very much, and right now that's due because of a lack of moisture.
Okay.
So the grass itself is not growing very much. We're not mowing it, but we tend to have heavy dews at night, so the grass is wet. So we have the perfect environment for the rust. It will cause the grass to turn kind of yellow, and when you walk across it, your feet will turn kind of orangey-brown.
Right.
So it is kind of annoying in that regard. It should go away on its own. What you might want to do maybe is go ahead and maybe, if you can, maybe fertilize today or this evening before the rain.
Okay.
And with the rain and the moisture, that should encourage the grass to grow and the rust should kind of go away by itself. So we typically don't use a fungicide on that at all. We just encourage the grass to grow more rapidly, and when it does, the rust kind of fades away.
Should I mow it first?
Oh, I don't think I would. I'd probably put on the fertilizer
Okay. And
hope that we get the rain. And if we get the rain and the fertilizer, the growing conditions still are quite favorable for the grass. And that should encourage it to grow. And then we'll have to mow it maybe in another week or so.
Okay.
But typically, no fungicide. Just encourage the grass to grow more rapidly.
Okay, very good. Thank you.
Thanks a lot, Barbara. And you can join our conversation at 866-780-9100. We have an email from Sarah who says, I have an infestation of fruit flies, but she doesn't want to use chemicals to kill the fruit flies because she has a small child. So do you have any suggestions?
Find the source is the suggestion, which will be easier said than done, especially at this time of the year. It could be that the fruit flies you have on the kitchen counter and around the bananas and overripe tomatoes on your kitchen counter, they could be invaders from outside, in which case cooler temperatures will take care of them and they will disappear. If, though, you are producing lots of new, fresh fruit flies every day and you continue to produce new fruit flies after the weather turns cold, that means you have a source inside your house, and that is usually a drain. And it will be a drain that you don't use very often. It may be the drain next to the furnace in the basement. It may be a shower that you don't use. It could be a bathtub that drains very, very slowly. And a layer of slime, a gelatinous film, I guess I should call it, has built up on the inside of the pipe above the water line, and the flies are breeding in that site. What we suggest is chunks of Saran wrap or other plastic wrap over the drains for a while and see if you don't trap the flies on their way up out of the drain. They'll be walking upside down on the underside of your plastic wrap. That tells you that drain needs to be physically cleaned, not drain cleaner, not a chemical treatment, no bleach, no vinegar, nothing. But you have to get in there and physically remove...
Scrape the gunk out.
Scrape the gunk out. I'm glad you put it so delicately, Charity. We love the bluntness of public radio. And that when you figure out which drain it is, when you get the gunk scraped out, the problem will go away.
All right. I've often wondered how fruit flies do seem to appear as if from thin air.
Oh, it's spontaneous generation. Don't you remember that?
It seems to be like that.
You put out fruit and the flies appear.
So if you do have fruit flies in your house and, you know, you want to take care of some of that population, do you recommend traps or fly paper? What seems to work?
Well, you can trap the adult flies, but all you're doing is harvesting the dumb ones. You're not solving the problem. You're just taking the few off the top.
Okay.
As long as the population is breeding down there in the drain next to the furnace in the basement, there will be more that are coming out. But people are enthralled with traps. They love to see squirming dead dying insects. And a trap can be a little saucer with some vinegar in it. I find it personally to be a waste of good material, but you could put just a little red wine in a saucer and leave it out, and the fruit flies will be attracted to those fermenting liquids. They'll fall in and they'll drown. So you can trap them, but all you're doing is taking a few off the top.
All right. Earl is on the line from West Des Moines. Hello, Earl.
Good morning. I had a question on ginkgos. I heard your comments earlier. I've had a couple of ginkgos that volunteered in the yard, so I'm sure they're from the fruit from the neighbor's tree. My question is, how long do I have to wait before I can tell if they're male or female?
That's another sore point. Oftentimes it's quite long, so it may be 15, 20 years before you know if it's male or female. And by then it's going to be a fairly large tree. So it's quite some time. And the only thing that you find eventually, because the flowers are quite small, and it's really hard to tell by looking at the flowers whether they're male or female. The only way to really tell is when you see those fruit. And when you see those, you know exactly what you've got. It's a female. So it may be 15, 20 years before you know. And if they did come up from seed, then obviously it's 50-50 as far as what they are.
Okay. So in the meantime, I have 15 to 20 years to enjoy them.
Right.
Yes.
Sell the house.
Sell the house and let somebody else worry about it.
All right, Earl. Thank you so much for your call. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can also tweet us at IPR Talk or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And we got an email from Jessica, and she says, I looked up pictures of this brown stink bug we were talking about, and I think this is the bug that I had a lot of when I lived in rural Butler County by Green about 5 years ago. The bug that I had smelled like Play-Doh. Could it be the same one?
I'm guessing not. If we had had the brown marmorated stink bug 5 years ago, we would have claimed the national record. We would be listed in all the entomological journals as the first location for it. There are lots of stink bugs, and they all stink, and they all feed on half of them feed on plants during the summertime. But there's also, if she's talking about the side of her house, there is a different insect called the leaf-footed bug, which looks like a stink bug, only longer. And it does smell bad. It smells badly also, stinks. And it comes from pine trees, where it feeds on the growing pine cones. So there's too many possibilities, and especially if we're talking about something in the past, there's too many possibilities to check this out for sure. But we still offer free identification of insects that are submitted digitally. So use your cell phone or your camera to take a digital picture of what you think might be a new invasive insect. And if you send that to me at insects, plural, INSECTS, insects@iastate.edu, eventually I'll get around to opening your email, look at your picture, and send you back a identification.
All right. And I don't think Play-Doh smells that badly.
But well, it depends, I guess, on what other things you've mixed into it over the years.
It's a matter of taste.
It's a matter of taste.
All right. Dave is on the line from Boone. Hello, Dave.
Hi.
What's your question?
Well, I've been losing soft needle pines in my backyard where the needles turn brown and get brittle, fall off, and then nothing ever comes back. And eventually, I guess I've just cut some of the trees down, and I've got a couple left, and I'd like to save them if I could. And I wondered if there's something I could do, if there's something that's maybe eating at them. Or
What kind of pine tree are they, as far as a Scotch pine?
I think they're a Scotch pine.
Okay. Well, if they were a Scotch pine, the biggest problem with Scotch pine is pine wilt, which is a disease. It's typically a fatal disease. And when they get pine wilt, the affected trees die very suddenly, usually in a matter of a few weeks.
Yes, that's what it did. Yeah, it died real pretty quickly.
So,
and it was in close proximity to another one, and I worry that whatever was on the one that died will affect this one now, or it already has affected it. Maybe, I don't know, but it's still green anyway. It's not turning brown yet.
So when this happens, you have a Scotch pine that looks perfectly healthy, nice and green. And within like 3 to 4 months, it's totally brown. It's totally dead.
Yeah.
And so when you have pine wilt, that's actually caused by a small little nematode, which is a microscopic worm. It gets inside the vascular tissue. It multiplies very rapidly. And it basically disrupts the flow of water from the roots to the branches and the needles. And so the tree dies very suddenly. The bad news is that there's no way to cure that. And there's really no good way to prevent that either. So over the last 15 to 20 years, most of the Scotch pines in Iowa have been slowly dying. You just see one here dying, then another one over here dying.
Yeah.
And it's just been a gradual process. And I would guess in a few years, maybe another 10 or 15 years, you're not going to see very many Scotch pines for that reason. They're just kind of gradually dying out. So the best thing that you can do typically is when you see a Scotch pine die, just cut it down and get rid of it. That's the best you can do.
As soon as possible.
As soon as possible. And hope that in doing so, maybe the surviving Scotch pines might last a few more years if you do that.
But nothing I can do to treat the nematodes or any of that?
Nope, unfortunately not. So hopefully you cut them down, and hopefully the trees that are still there might survive for a few more years. I guess the other thing I would do would be to maybe plan for their demise. And maybe start putting in other things like maybe Norway spruce or maybe some firs and things like that in the area so that when they do die, then you have replacements.
Okay. Hey, would you mind if I ask a quick follow-up question on the ginkgos?
Okay.
I did have that situation where I bought a house where the homeowner had planted a ginkgo years earlier. And when I bought the house, I'm from the nearby Ames, so I was familiar with the female versus male. And he told me mine was a male, and I believed him because there was no nuts, but I hadn't lived at the house too long, maybe a few years, and it decided it was a female, and it started producing nuts, and they were just terrible. And I don't know, the neighbor across the street has one that doesn't produce nuts, so I assume his is a male.
Mm-hmm. Probably.
I don't know if his would be pollinating mine then, or maybe that's not the way this happens.
No, probably it is.
Okay.
You have the pollinators and those that produce the fruit.
Although my question is, I teach him all the time that I was deciding between whether I would cut my tree down or go over at night and cut his tree down to save mine. And now I tease him. Now I have cut mine down and gotten rid of it because it was just too much to bear anymore. It was just the nuts were just so terrible smelling.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder now, I tease him now that where there's a will, there's a way. And I feel his might change from being male to female because it's just got to produce the nuts somehow.
Well, they can do that. Normally, if they're a male, they're a male, but sometimes they're not always in that category, so where they could change a little bit. But hopefully it's just a male and stay that way. But the actual fruit inside there, they kind of have like a nut inside the actual fleshy fruit, and the actual nut inside there is actually edible. It's that fleshy material on the outside of it that gives it that very rancid-type smell. But the actual nut inside is actually edible, and it's actually used in Oriental dishes.
And it doesn't taste like it smells.
No, it doesn't.
That's just the outside, just like a husk on a walnut.
Mm-hmm.
I have seen people gathering ginkgos, nuts.
On campus.
On campus.
Iowa
you see
State.
People gathering them up, and they have a reason for them, so no matter how bad they smell, maybe they still have a purpose.
Right, and I'm sure everyone blesses them for taking them away as well. So, Dave, thank you so much for your call. And we have Carl on the line in Pella. Hello, Carl.
Well, hi. Thanks for your nice program. I say the question I have, I'm sure I heard it in your program, what to do with coffee grinds. I saved a whole bunch of them up, and I forgot what to do with them.
Well, you can add those to your compost pile. They are organic matter, so if you have, like, leaves and grass clippings and garden debris, you can add those to your compost pile. That's a good way to get rid of them.
Mm-hmm.
You typically just don't sprinkle them in the garden. I wouldn't do that. I would just put them in the compost pile.
Oh, okay. Is it too late to put grass seed out now?
Yeah, it is. We typically like to do that sometime in late summer, usually between late August and mid-September. Now we're getting into late October, and it's really probably too late.
All right, Carl, thank you so much for your call. And next up, we have Dolores on the line in Griswold. Hello, Dolores.
Hello.
Hi, what's your question?
In my garden, I have a bunch of holes about 1.5 to 2 inches around. You go down about 2 inches, and then it goes off to a tunnel. But there is no raised dirt anywhere around them, but the holes are like 5 feet apart or something all over. What have I got?
Well, we aren't sure. Cicada killer wasps make that size of a hole, and frequently the female is very good about scattering the soil that comes out of the hole. And by now, holes usually blend shut. They get washed shut with rainfall. So that
no,
would be.
It hasn't rained here.
It hasn't rained here either, but we've got our fingers crossed for tomorrow now for the benefit of our lawns. So,
what can I do? Can I put the hose down and?
Oh, I don't think I would bother at this time of the year. You might take your flashlight and sit out there at night and see if anybody comes out. But
all right,
yeah, you know that just to sort of solve the mystery.
And aren't we having meteor showers right now too? So you
well,
can.
But then you have to be looking up and down at the same time.
I got one eye for each place.
There you go. So you know that's the only insect that would do that. Now that size hole could be crayfish, but they bring up a lot of mud, and you'd have to live really close to a stream for that possibility.
No. How about voles or something like that?
No, they're not down in the ground, and chipmunks will hide in your downspouts before they would dig much of a hole. And shrews aren't really tunnelers either. How long is it till the wildlife program, Charity?
A few weeks.
A few weeks. Okay, so maybe.
I also have a yard full of garter snakes.
Oh.
My cats won't bother them at all.
Yeah. I think when the wildlife program is on, call back and maybe you'll get an alternate answer that's actually more useful to you.
All right. Well, I'm sorry we don't have a definitive answer for you, Dolores.
Well, thank you anyhow.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
Bye.
Next up, we have Eldon on the line from Atkins at 866-780-9100. Hello, Eldon.
Good morning, folks.
Hi.
I have a question about the tulip tree. I saw one down in... Keokuk in that area, and I wondered if that type of tree would be able to be grown like west of Cedar Rapids.
I would think so. You want to choose your site somewhat carefully in that they would like a moist soil, so maybe not out in the open, in a very open exposed site, but maybe somewhat protected, maybe near a building or some other structure, or maybe some older trees where it has some protection. It can potentially get to be very big. So trying to look for kind of a moist, well-drained soil and kind of a protected location in the landscape.
We live in the country, so I could plant it near a barn or a large outbuilding. That would probably be enough protection.
But it can get to be a big, huge tree. So just try to find some place where it's not really extremely hot, dry, and windy, and it would do better in that type of exposure.
The huge one that's here on campus is on the east side of LeBaron Hall.
Right.
And it's a huge, beautiful tree,
right.
And when it's in bloom, when it's in flower, it's really a unique flower and fun to see.
It is, with the kind of yellow-green, with the orange. Kind of looks like a tulip.
Mm-hmm.
Very unique.
Yeah,
also a very unique leaf, too.
Yeah, but that's a protected location because it's on the east side, but it's nearly out in full sun still, but it's got that whole three-story building to protect it from the north and the west winds of winter. And that one does very, very well. And so you're probably in the same zone as campus.
Yes. Another question about hard maple that would be long-lived.
Sugar maple would be a good tree, I think, for your area. It's native to eastern Iowa. It has very nice fall color that varies from yellow to orange. It's much sturdier than some of the other maples, like the silver maple and some of the silver maple-red maple hybrids. So I would definitely look at a sugar maple or possibly a black maple, which is very closely related to the sugar maple. Again, native to Iowa, and actually is a little bit more drought tolerant than the sugar maple.
All right. Well, Eldon, thank you so much for your call. We have an email from someone in Iowa City who says, is there something I can do over the winter to get rid of a yellow jacket nest that is a couple of feet from my house? Midsummer, I bumped a decaying log and heard a buzzing sound from the ground that started getting louder, and it didn't take me long to realize there were some kind of bees or hornets getting stirred up, so I left. Later in the fall, it seemed like they were flying in and out a lot more, and I got stung once when I was several yards away. I've left them and the decaying log alone, but I wonder what to do next.
Continue on your present course. Leave them alone. Winter will take care of this for you. Yellow jackets, bald-faced hornets, bumblebees all have annual colonies. That is, they start from scratch with a single queen in the springtime, usually about May, and that colony builds through the summer and reaches its peak just right about the time after the state fair. And then the new queens that are produced in these annual colonies, the new queens come out, they fly in the air, they mate with males from other colonies, and then those mated new queens go into hibernation in the wood pile, under the loose bark of dead trees, other protected locations like under the leaf litter and so forth, and they will start new colonies next year. The colony that is here now is doomed to freeze to death within the next few weeks, and no one will come back and reuse the same nest a second time. So your control is do nothing. Winter will do it for you.
All right. And we have time for just one more question. This is Lisa on the line in Vinton. Hello, Lisa.
Hi.
What's your question?
I have a question relating back to the pine trees. My pine trees, I don't know what kind they are, but they seem to die from the bottom up.
Okay.
And the needles don't turn brown all at once. They die slowly from the bottom up.
Okay.
And we have quite a big grove of them. We took about six of them down this spring that were dying, and now the ones that we left standing, I think, are progressively dying from the bottom up. And I guess I just want to know if we should take all the other ones down, if it's going to spread or what.
Okay. Well, the first thing that I would do probably would be to send a sample into the plant diagnostic clinic here at Iowa State to see if there's a disease involved in that. And basically what they would like to have would be two or three small branches from one of the trees. And you want to select branches that are clearly showing what you're concerned about. So the end of the branch might be green, but below that you might have quite a few brown needles. That would be a good branch. So you prune off two or three small branches, maybe a foot, foot and a half in length, put them in a plastic bag, then bring them down to the county extension office, and have them send those into the plant diagnostic clinic here at Iowa State. They'll also have a form, a plant disease form, that you fill out with your contact information, a description of what the trees look like, and that may be useful too. And that way they'll have a sample, they can identify the tree as far as what kind it is, and then examine that to see if there's any sign of insects or disease. And they'll get back to you with the information.
And brace yourself. We're just seeing lots and lots of conifers die from bad weather, planted too closely,
right,
planted too deeply. Often there is not a cure for what is environmental stress from planting site, planting conditions, or especially in the last couple of years, bad weather.
Right.
All right. So prepare yourself for bad news. Richard Geron and Donald Lewis from Iowa State University Extension, thank you both so much.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.